Our next responder is no stranger to us. John Williamson has been intimately involved in public commentary here in Canada for many years. His past public policy work has focused primarily on taxation, government spending, parliamentary reform, and political developments in Canada, the United States, and the Far East. His opinion columns are regularly printed in the National Post and other daily newspapers across Canada. He's a past national director of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, the country's leading nonpartisan tax research and advocacy organization, as well as a former National Post editorial writer and founding member of the paper's editorial board. He is currently closer to Ian's side of the pond than our side at this time. He's undertaking his Master of Science graduate degree in economic history at the London School of Economics. He's been named a Chevening Scholar at the British Government's Foreign and Commonwealth Office. He's a senior fellow with the Fraser Institute, a fellow with the Manning Center for Building Democracy, recipient of the Humane Studies Fellowship from the Institute of Humane Studies at George Mason University, and he comes to us now. Please join us, John.
Good afternoon. It's good to be back in cold Ottawa. I've been out of the country for 6 months. I left in September. It was a pleasant day. Had a coffee and a bagel outside, and I come back to the wind yesterday. So it's funny how you forget things very, very quickly when you're away. When Dave first contacted me about today's event, he had mentioned these new ideas, which actually in the UK have been dubbed Red Toryism. And of course, for a lot of us in this room, as conservatives, when you hear Red Tories, ideas put forward by Red Tories, the first instinct is, of course, to get out your knives and sharpen them. Because, as we all know, Red Tories tend to think they can just implement liberal ideas better than liberals can. I tend to think it's an ideology that involves surrender and defeatism more than advancing the agenda and pushing for responsible change. I must say there's nothing cowardly at all about some of the ideas that Ian Duncan-Smith is putting forward. In fact, quite the opposite in terms of the impact, I think, both on the government and as well society at large. Dave also asked me to talk a little bit about or look at some of the fiscal ramifications of some of these ideas, and that's a bit hard to do, so I'm not going to focus too much on the numbers in terms of what it means to the budget, the Government of Canada, for example, work that I did until very recently with the Taxpayers Federation. I would almost say that given the current financial mess we find ourselves in, governments really have a choice. Either nothing is impossible because of deficits, or in fact, everything is. I mean, it seems in a certain sense that we're putting pretty much everything on the table in terms of dealing with the financial crisis. So why not put a few other ideas on the table in terms of how do we create a better society moving forward? So I think the challenge that we're looking at in terms of adopting some of these ideas is how, in fact, we marry together, bring together the fiscal issues and the social issues. I will give you some numbers very, very quickly, actually, just to kind of give you a sense of the opportunity. Every year, the Government of Canada spends $25 billion, $26 billion, on discretionary spending. These are transfers to individuals, businesses, or community groups. This is not money that goes to CPP, the pension program. It doesn't go to employment insurance. It doesn't go to Medicare or anything like that. It's just straight transfers of dollars that are discretionary and that the Parliament of Canada has the ability to review without impacting, actually, by and large, the social programs that Canadians receive. The exception, actually, and it is a big chunk of change, $10 billion of that does go to native reserves, but even if you take that off the table, that still leaves you $15, $16 billion a year that you can do some pretty dramatic things in terms of spending differently or cutting, lowering taxes. The question, I suppose, is the issue of social justice, will it resonate with the public? And I think the answer, it's qualified yes. I think it's important to pick the right issues and to campaign on those issues. As I make my comments today, I do actually want to point out that I'm not here representing the Manning Center for Democracy, nor the Fraser Institute. I'm going to try to address my comments more in the tune of an editorial how these ideas could be perceived by the public and by political parties at large. So the starting point is, I think, for everyone to acknowledge, and I say this as a fiscal conservative and tax cutter myself, fiscal issues are just not enough to win elections these days. If we run on just a campaign of cutting taxes, spending less, we're not going to do that well. There is no viable libertarian party in the world that I'm aware of that runs on the idea of small government and tax relief and does well at the polls. But instead, it involves marrying social issues with that vision. The other reason why we're not going to win on fiscal issues is because, frankly, the Liberals are also very competitive on this issue. The Liberals are the party that pulled Canada out of deficits a decade ago. The Conservative Party is the party that has plunged Canada back into deficit spending. So to get up on the campaign trail and suggest the Conservative Party is a party of fiscal prudence and caution, it's not a message that's going to resonate very long or very well with voters. So I think that's a danger for the Conservative government. Now, of course, where there's danger, there's also opportunity. And I think, let me give you an example of the impact of a social issue that the Conservatives won or campaigned on and won on. And that was the debate, I was going to say two elections ago, but I'm losing track. We have them so often now. 05-06, so that was three elections ago. Daycare versus childcare. I was at the Taxpayers Federation at that time, and it was obvious that you cannot fight an idea with nothing. Even if it's a bad idea, if the other side's putting up something, we need to have a credible response to that. So for years, the opposition or Liberal, the big L status Liberals, had been pushing the idea of institutional daycare for all children across this country. The idea is that families would give up their kids, ship them off to institutional program where they would be taught how to be kids, I suppose, and maybe learn, they'd be taught all kinds of things that they don't get at home. Well, eventually, I think the Conservatives generally and the party as well recognized that they needed a solution to this, or they needed an answer to this problem, and their solution was the idea of child care, the idea that we would entrust parents to actually raise their kids, and government would make that job a little bit easier. So we had two visions of child care, daycare, and not only was ours the one that favored families, it was also the one that was and is more popular. But I'm going to tell you something about that. The cost of the program was twice as much in terms of the cost of that program under the Conservatives was actually double what it was under the Liberals. The Liberals had earmarked $1 billion for their daycare plan, and the Conservative plan, as it's constituted now, that's $100 a month for every child under the age of six, was about $2 billion. And what's really interesting is that this was the first new universal federal program to be introduced, I think, since the late 1960s. Ken Bosenquil is nodding, so I'm correct on that. And what's amazing is that passed without Conservatives batting an eye. And why was that? It's because it was the left screaming that this was not a good program, and it was families, and I would say Conservative activists, party supporters, saying these are the kind of ideas we need more of. Not only are they right, not only are they the right ideas, but they're also ideas that win votes. It doesn't create a new bureaucracy, it's not social engineering, and it puts families at the heart of family decisions. Now, turning to the specifics of looking ahead, I think one of the challenges for the Conservative movement is identifying some of these social problems. Ian Duncan Smith mentioned several of them, as has Jennifer and David, but I would actually argue that, in fact, there's a lot of work to be done on this file. For example, the Aboriginal file we're all familiar with, $10 billion a year is spent on and off Native reserves, $9 billion on Native reserves, $1 billion to Natives living off reserves. And we're familiar with how bad public policy has resulted in bad outcomes. And it's amazing because if you look around the world today, no matter how you measure it, you see that countries and societies are doing better. If you want to measure it by per capita GDP, as Conservatives like to do, It's unmistakable over the last 50, 100 years. It doesn't matter if things are getting better. If you want to use the UN measurement, Human Development Index, even by the UN standards, you see rising income levels or rising outcomes in terms of education, healthcare, and these things. When it comes to our own Aboriginal reserves in this country, we see actually quite the opposite. We see stagnation, we see lack of opportunity, we see poor education standards, we see substance abuse, families broken by alcohol dependency. It just goes on and on and on. That's one example. That's a tough area, I think, for conservative parties to deal with it, not because we don't have a lot of the answers, but I think as well, at a certain level, it's going to take the Aboriginal leadership to stand up and want to change the system themselves. Otherwise, it is just the white man going on about these changes. So in terms of other areas where we should and could look to for change, there's the unemployment insurance scheme, for example. I'm not aware of, actually, data that talks about EI in terms of the impact on families, breakups, the results on kids. I'm very familiar with the economic implications of EI, which is, say, in Atlantic Canada. Not only has it created an environment where it is tougher for businesses to get off the ground, but it has at the same time created an economy where you have high unemployment and a labor shortage. I mean, these two things do not generally go together, yet they do in Atlantic Canada because of the perverse incentives of EI. So I think it's important that we begin to look at some of these federal programs in terms of the impact on social justice issues, and in terms of what are the broader implications of society. The other result of that EI system, in terms of demographics, and this is where it begins to hit some family issues, is we're finding that there are just too few families with young children in the Maritimes who are staying there. They're going to places like Alberta, the Prairies, Vancouver, Ontario, and as a result of that, the governments in Atlantic Canada are finding that they just don't have the revenue base to fund tomorrow's social programs. I think it's important as well to highlight that people do respond to incentives. If it's EI, welfare, common law benefits, government policy does matter, and it is I think important to remember that, because good policies will result in good outcomes, and bad policies will result in bad outcomes. A good example of this in terms of helping people with a low income is the working income tax benefit, otherwise known as WITB. That addresses some of the issues that were raised just a few minutes ago, in terms of signaling to people, if you do something to help yourselves by working, the government will not pull back all of the benefits that you've been receiving. It sends the signal that, in fact, if you go out and work, you will be able to keep that income, and the government will allow benefits to remain. They are slowly clawed back in a manner that I think sends the right signal. Just a few other issues in terms of opportunities moving ahead. I'm going to come back to the childcare daycare debate, because I do not think that issue is over. I actually think this is a bipartisan issue, particularly if you get out of Ottawa. I think this is one area where we'll find strength. It's not well known, but the province of New Brunswick actually has put in place their own child care policy. And it is an almost identical replica of the federal conservative plan. Instead of $100 a month, it's $50 a month. These kind of ideas should be highlighted, I think, because of the bipartisan aspect, to highlight to other jurisdictions, to taxpayers, to voters, to families, where provinces are going in terms of policies that will help families with children. A few other ideas I'm going to put on the table are a little more controversial, both in terms of their social impact, but as well, just I think amongst conservatives, in terms of conservative thinking. In terms of education, if the provinces don't want to act, what about the idea of a federal charter schools, for example, to signal to communities and families that, in fact, if their school is not working for them, it might be possible to bypass a bad system that's not working. In terms of EI, in EI reform, currently under EI, family which has a child is permitted to collect benefits for a year. In general times, let's put aside the financial crisis, the EI runs a surplus of $2 to $3 billion a year. We could make a deal with advocates of lower taxes. Let's use that surplus, half to lower the premiums, to create jobs, and half to help families with kids by boosting the amount of time on maternity from a year to 2 years. Another idea, for a family that has a third child, cut the CPP payroll tax in half. Once they have that third child, they've done that bit to ensure pensions are going to be there for the next generation. So it's just gravy at that point. The second last point I'm going to throw out here, more as an idea, it's not something that I've given a lot of thought to, but I think it addressed squarely with what the speaker said at lunch. What about the idea of repealing common law benefits in this country? I always felt that one reason why we had the common law, I think there are two reasons. One, it was a slow expansion of the state that disregarded the importance of families. That was, I think, the main objection of this scheme. But eventually, I got the impression that it was there also as a way to allow same-sex couples to access benefits at a time before the time when gay marriage was recognized in this country. We'll leave that debate aside for now. My point is, if gay couples can now collect benefits when they're married, what's the point of this law anyway? All it does is undermine traditional families and sends the signal to people, if you're not married, you can collect the same amount of benefits as a couple that is. If you want to send the signal that marriage matters, I think you have to make it matter, and you do that through the policies and the programs that are available to people. I think it's a radical idea, but it's one I think that we ought to at least consider. Finally, I'm going to come back to an issue that Dave and I and others have talked about a lot, and that's the whole idea of income splitting. I think this actually is an area that the daycare advocates most fear. I think it involves a huge battle, but I think it is one that both can be defended on social grounds as well as economic grounds. I'm not going to get into the debate here today about that. I think we're all familiar with it. But it does, again, send the right signals to the public, which is who should be responsible for the family structure, parents or bureaucrats? And the idea of setting up the tax scheme so families can organize their affairs better in terms of how they're going to raise their kids, how they're going to work, who they're going to have to stay home with the kids, I think is something that's best left to parents and not to the state by way of all sorts of tax credits and income deductions or benefits in terms of benefits that are available if people put their kids in daycare. And I think actually another point that's worth remembering is that we don't want to target benefits. That is, I think, the road to disaster, because again, if you target benefits in terms of an income cutoff, that people will again change their behavior to capture those benefits. So universality with clawbacks, for example, so as people improve their conditions, they do keep more of that income, and they begin to whittle off the social programs. I think that's really about it. I'll end right now just so we can go into some questions, but I think actually there's one thing that Ian Duncan, that I have read that he has said, and I think it's very, very valid wherever you are in the world, and that is voters look for credible answers from the political parties, and they're really not going to look to political leaders that talk about ideas but really can't back them up in terms of where they want to go and how they're going to get there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. You brought several thoughts forward. Parents versus the state, who has the family's best interest at heart? One of my favorites, family income splitting, so thank you for bringing that forward again today. You have economic implications on social justice issues, that they do tie in, they do matter, they do make a difference to each other, and that where there is danger, there is opportunity. Many would say these are dangerous times. That must make them times for opportunity right now as well. We have about 15 minutes.